All right, cool. So this is our fifth basic Buddhist teachings class. Basically, if you were to ask the Buddha the question of how to walk the path of practice, he essentially would say ethical behavior and mindfulness. Now, mindfulness, so last week, I think we talked about the Eightfold Path, and right, mindfulness was one aspect of the Eightfold Path, and right meditation was one aspect of the Eightfold Path. Oh, I forgot to put this on. Hold on, more electronics.
I don't know if it's turned on or not.
Is the control box on?
Oh, yet another question.
Hello, hello. Yes. All right, there we go. So I'll talk a little bit about what is right mindfulness versus what is right dhyana or concentration or meditation. So in terms of mindfulness, mindfulness comes from it's a translation of the Pali term sati, which basically means to remember or keep in mind. So this is a kind of a description by Tanisiro Bhikkhu from the Access to Insight website. And he's talking, this is his intro paragraph to the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the four foundations of mindfulness sutta, which is basically, this is the core, like four foundations of mindfulness teaching of the Buddha. The word Satipatthana is the name for an approach to meditation aimed at establishing sati or mindfulness. The term sati is related to the verb sarati, to remember or keep in mind. It is sometimes translated as non-reactive awareness, free from agendas, simply present with whatever arises. But the formula of Satipatthana doesn't support that translation. So that's kind of the modern, more secular definition of mindfulness practice, is kind of non-judgmental awareness. So Tanisiro continues, non-reactive awareness is actually an aspect of equanimity, a quality fostered in the course of Satipatthana. The activity of Satipatthana, however, definitely has a motivating agenda, the desire for awakening, which is classed not as a cause of suffering, but as part of the path to its ending. The role of mindfulness is to keep the mind properly grounded in the present moment in a way that will keep it on the path. To make an analogy, awakening is like a mountain on the horizon, the destination to which you are driving a car. Mindfulness is what remembers to keep attention focused on the road to the mountain, rather than letting it stay focused on glimpses of the mountain or get distracted by other paths leading away from the road. So mindfulness is that, oh, right, I'm going to the mountain and I need to pay attention to this road in order to get there. And you may have heard my analogy as well. If let's say you are birding and you have a pair of binoculars, and mindfulness is like is keeping what it is that you're trying to see in the field of the binoculars, right? Instead of like, oh, what's going over there? Okay, all right, I'm bringing it back into the field. So the emphasis on mindfulness acknowledges our tendency to forgetfulness and distraction. And it's very purposeful. So modern secular awareness tends to emphasize that non-judgmental open awareness, particularly of the breath or body. And those are aspects of the Buddhist path of mindfulness, but Buddhist mindfulness is much more. And as part of the Eightfold Path, it's right mindfulness. So as I talked about last week, right means that which works, that which is effective, that which is correct, like the right key for the door. That's the right path to get to the mountain. That path doesn't lead to the mountain. That path does. So right mindfulness is not just, staying focused. It's staying focused on the right things. It's staying focused on things that will actually help you get to the mountain. So you could be putting your binoculars, you could be peeping Tom on somebody else's house, right? There's like lots of things you could be paying attention to, which are not helpful. So this is like, this is paying attention to what is helpful, according to the teachings. So I'm going to share a little bit from the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishings of mindfulness. And essentially first, we have mindfulness of the body, which includes mindfulness of breathing and posture and like the it's called the unattractiveness of the body, but it's really like contemplating the fact that we're made up of like fleshy parts and phlegm and bones and whatever, kind of, seeing through the infatuation with the body and the impermanence of the body. And then it's mindfulness, contemplation of feelings, which I will explain a little bit about, and then contemplation of mind states, and then contemplations of what is often called phenomena or mental qualities. But it's, if you look at the list of things you're supposed to contemplate, it's really like the Dharma. It's really, the Four Noble Truths. It's so I will talk more about each one of these. So this is pretty much for each of these different areas, this oral tradition text tends to read fairly much the same. And how monk dwell contemplating the body in the body? Here a monk, gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise in front of him, just mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I will breathe in experiencing the whole body. I will breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation. Just as a skilled lathe worker or his apprentice, when making a long turn, he understands, I make a long turn. Or when making a short turn, he understands, I make a short turn with the breath. In this way, he dwells contemplating the body in the body internally, or he dwells contemplating the body in the body externally, or contemplating the body in the body both internally and externally. So in this contemplating the body in the body, the breath in the breath, and later feelings in the feelings, etc., the practitioner is not thinking about breathing or thinking about the body, or it's not, we're up here, we're like using the body as a meditative object. It's like full experience. You are, or maybe to phrase a little differently, you are mindful of the body with the body. You don't separate yourself from your breath. It's just pure awareness of the breath. So dwell in contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or dwell contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or dwell contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness, there is a body, is simply established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. So in particular, each of these things that end up being the object of mindfulness, we notice, this is the goal anyway, right? Is that we pay such close attention that we notice the changes. We notice how everything changes. And therefore, things are impermanent, and therefore things are not self. And therefore, so we're like, it's like through this direct mindfulness, we end up perceiving these deep Buddhist truths that we've been talking about earlier, right? Of dukkha and not self. So then further mindfulness of the body. A monk understands I am walking. When standing, he understands I am standing. When sitting, I am sitting. When lying down, I am lying down. So if you think about that awareness of your body throughout the day, where are you? What are you doing? What are you doing with your hands? There is in this particular sutta, there is as part of the mindfulness of the body, there are 9 contemplations you do. You go to a charnel ground where it's not just that it's dead bodies, that it's not just a cemetery where bodies have been buried. Bodies are out and they're in various stages of decay and they're going to be burned and whatever. So you go and contemplate the body there and contemplate, like, I am also like this. And the monk reviews this same body as consisting of elements, earth element, water element, fire, air. So the idea is that through this, we stop clinging to the body so much. Then there's contemplation, mindfulness of feelings. Now, feelings in this context are very simple feelings. In the Buddhist definition, when we say feelings, it means aversion, attraction, or indifference, and all the various versions of that. But it's not complex emotions like love or anger or anything like that. It's just, you know, this, no, we don't like that. Oh, yes, I like that. I want more of that. Or it doesn't make any difference to me. So the monk dwells contemplating feelings in feelings, pleasant feeling, aware when you have a painful feeling, neither pleasant nor painful, various kinds of pleasant feelings, a carnal pleasant feeling, a spiritual pleasant feeling, or spiritual painful feeling, dwells contemplating in feelings in feelings. Mindfulness, there is feeling. I think this is something that many of us experience, I mean, perhaps before practice per se, but certainly as we begin practice, we become able to, just for a moment, and just, I'm going to talk about more complex emotions as well, but let's say anger is arising in me, right? As opposed to just, I am angry, just being caught in it. And certainly that aversion and attraction, if we're just carried away by it, we're not really calling the shots anymore, right? It's our desire or aversion that is. But when we become aware of it, we can say, you know, a feeling of aversion is arising. And potentially then maybe we don't have to enact that. And when we contemplate mind, so we're talking about mind states. So we notice a mind with lust or without lust, with hatred or without hatred, delusion or without delusion. So there's a very specific list here. A contracted mind versus a mind that is not contracted. A distracted mind versus a mind that is not distracted. An exalted mind or unexalted. Surpassable or unsurpassable. Concentrated or unconcentrated. Liberated or unliberated. So there's elsewhere where in the canon where it describes more about exactly what is meant by these things. So again, this contemplation of these things, we begin to become familiar with how they manifest, and we become familiar with how they arise and how they pass. These experiences that we have, that we usually identify with so much. And then we're getting to contemplation of what I call the Dhamma. I don't know why they don't call it mindfulness of, but maybe because the Dhamma is not like a bunch of extra ideas. It's pointing toward reality. So contemplating, you know, once we've developed some mindfulness, awareness of the body and feelings and mind states, then we start to like, all right, you know, what is up with this universe? So essentially, we contemplate the presence or absence of the five hindrances within us. And I'm going to be talking about those in another class. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth, restlessness, and doubt. So we learn to recognize those things when they have arisen in us, or noticing when they haven't arisen in us. Then we contemplate the ephemeral, not self nature of the five aggregates, which is something I think that's next week. The five aggregates of which we're composed are body, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. So now we're starting to really break down our experience and notice in what sense we are not in control of these things, and these things are impermanent, and therefore they are not self as we would like to think they are. Then we have presence or absence of the seven factors of awakening, which is, again, these lists overlap, mindfulness, analysis of qualities, persistence, rapture, calm, concentration, and equanimity. So this is, I'm not going to do a class on the seven factors of awakening. This isn't one that we tend to refer to often in Zen, but it is just one of those lists, right? We have the five skandhas, we have the four brahmaviharas, there's the seven factors of awakening are another list. And then finally, we use mindfulness, right, to get things into our field of vision and our binoculars there. And then we're really examining the Four Noble Truths, the presence of dukkha, the nature of dukkha, how it arises, why it arises, how we cause it to arise by our resistance to the way things are, and how we can actually let that go. So in Theravada Buddhism and Vipassana, which is a modern version, it differs by lineage and teacher and school. But generally speaking, they really use these original teachings. And I mean, I'm not really speaking about this from experience. I did an episode on this on the podcast, and I talked to practitioners from other groups. And they really are this systematic about it. You know, if you're going to go to retreat, you are going to be working on some of this stuff. Start with the body, move on to the feelings. So just a note before I get to like, how does all of this relate to Zen? A note about right meditation or right concentration and how that relates to right mindfulness. So I found a really great little passage by a nun named Aya Kema. So she trained in Theravada Buddhism, but she, because in traditional Theravada lineages, full ordination for women is no longer available. So she got ordained in another lineage, but I think she always identified really as a Theravada nun. So it's a great, she said, deep tranquility and meditation is the underlying factor needed for profound insights, which can change an ordinary worldling to a noble one, which is the goal of our practice. So she describes how the critical insights that result in spiritual liberation occur as a result of a calm, clear mind, rather than from discursive thinking or analysis. When our minds are truly calm and stable, we can use them for concentrated investigation, which will reveal the deepest truths of Buddhism to us and allow us to relinquish all grasping after this life. And also, I thought this was really interesting. This ties it back to mindfulness. Concentrated investigation of phenomena is an aspect of our moment-to-moment mindfulness, which enables us to see anicca or impermanence, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, or anatta, she says, corelessness. To see this wherever we look. Everything that exists proclaims these three characteristics, so that we need never be without Dhamma consciousness. Usually one of the three aspects becomes more pregnant with meaning for us, and our mind veers in that direction to investigate the underlying truth behind the reality in which we live. We are never without an object for investigation. Our thoughts and feelings are full of these three characteristics. When is there a pleasant feeling? When there is a pleasant feeling, can we keep it? Do we feel unhappy when it is gone? Are we beginning to see this whole person we are so concerned with as nothing but flux and flow, with no solid core to be found anywhere? When we look at ourselves again and again, we will eventually realize that we cannot find an unchanging substance within. So to use my binoculars metaphor, if mindfulness is like pointing your binoculars at the right thing, at something that's going to be helpful, then it's like, you know, right meditation or right concentration would be the ability to, like, you know, focus those binoculars and stay at your task, right? Maybe, you know, I'm done with this. I want to go do something else, right? That we actually have to concentrate in order to perceive some of these things. So how do we hold all of this in Zen, particularly Soto Zen, where we do Shikantaza, where we don't do this kind of really directed, you know, now we're going to meditate on this and now we're going to meditate on that. The original, I mean, it's a little inaccurate for me to conflate like original Buddhism with Theravada Buddhism, just disclaimer, because Theravada Buddhism is like, you know, it's older than Zen. It's come down through the millennia and presumably it has evolved somewhat, but it has the aim of it just to stay quite conservative and quite true to the original texts and teachings. So, you know, presumably it is closer to the original teachings than Zen is. The original perspective seems to have been, and the current Theravada perspective is, that our minds are unruly and need to be diligently trained to do what we want them to do. So they use an analogy of a wild elephant. And the object of mindfulness, you know, especially when we're doing like that body mindfulness, the object of mindfulness is a steak. And apparently, I don't know, but apparently if you want to tame a wild elephant, you chain their foot to a stake and they keep trying to get away and eventually they give up in their chain. So that's the idea, is that your mind like tries to wander away, but then it comes back to the meditative object. And over time, your mind is more pliable. You can do more with it. I always wish that would come true for me, but it didn't. I mean, maybe it did. You know, I think sometimes we don't recognize the effects of practice in ourselves. We might just think about what we're, you know, not capable of doing. And yet, when you kind of think of like, if you imagine yourself going out in public, and I would guess that almost all of you are like much more mindful and present than the vast majority of the people around you. Just not that you're like super spiritual or something like that, but just, you know, you're probably more likely like, oh, look what's going on. Whereas most people don't even have that aspiration, right? Most people is just like, you know, got the headphones on, got the phone, it's just they're totally caught up in whatever it is they're doing and not really noticing where they are. So, I mean, I think we probably all have benefited from this practice in a pretty direct way. But this idea that we are taming the mind, it's just a different view of human nature. In Chan and Zen, in Mahayana and then Chan and Zen, develop more of an idea that we have an awakened, enlightened nature that has just gotten clouded over by delusions and self-concern. And so to some extent, all we have to do is let go of all that extra stuff we are generating, and then our true nature will manifest. So I think of this as kind of like, we have a different guiding metaphor, which is sit quietly in the forest until the elephant gets used to you and then, you know, comes over, and you can hold out a peanut, you know, like you gradually tame the elephant that way instead of this other way. So our pathway to meditative concentration and samadhi is different, but the goal really is the same. In Zen, we tend to use the term mindfulness to refer to the way we turn our minds when we are not on the meditation seat. I mean, you could be mindful while you're sitting on the meditation seat, but particularly if we're doing shikantaza or zazen, we're kind of let go of that idea of that kind of, you know, directed attention. But at all other times, like Ayakema was describing, we are never without a opportunity for Dharma investigation. Every experience that we have, every thought, every feeling, every interaction, everything we can try to experience deeply and see these different qualities, to become very, very familiar with the kinds of things that go through our minds, how they arise and pass, you know, cultivating the positive, recognizing the negative, and contemplating impermanence, no self, and dukkha. So we aren't systematic about it. And I think that can be frustrating for Zen students sometimes, where it's like, you know, give me a You know, what should I concentrate on next? What should I understand? Where's the list? Where's the curriculum? But I guess it's like, we just try to keep up that mindfulness throughout every moment of our day. And then for that meditative concentration, that is really, I mean, theoretically, we can do that anytime when we meditate, but it is something that's really the aim of session and retreat, the longer meditation retreats that we have. Because it tends, for most of us, it tends to take a day or two or three for our minds to just settle or get tired of all the stuff that it's trying to generate. So most of us end up like just experiencing a kind of spaciousness and stillness of mind in the course of retreat that we have been unable to do outside of retreat. And eventually the idea is that we can, right? That it's not just this special rarefied thing that we have to have retreat to do, but it's like retreat is so conducive to it that it shows us what's possible. And then at certain points, you know, I've talked about that mental map that we're usually carrying around, the mental map we've made of reality that we think is reality. You know, that's it. The retreat really encourages you to like just let go of your mental map. And, you know, it's not something necessarily that you can do willfully, right? Like, okay, I'll drop it right now. I mean, but if we just sit and we do this practice, then there may be a moment where it just, you know, it's just a moment where you're just looking out the window and you're just seeing the sun. Like there's no filter of self-concern or map. You go, So there's all kinds of various little or large insights that we can experience in that setting. So yeah, leave it there. And then we can, questions or comments about mindfulness. Julia.
Yes. So I'm still unsure how this mindfulness relates to shikantaza. So in shikantaza, we're supposed to just sit, but when we want to be mindful, we can do this like in whenever other situation, not shikantaza, right? Like mindful of the body or like the things you listed. I mean, I'm just thinking, can I just like, I don't know, sit comfortably on my couch and feel my body or whatever? Is this supposed to like, it's counting as mindfulness that you were talking about today, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know, when I think about shikantaza, the way that, you know, I'm describing it as like, aim at the correct posture with flesh and bones and leave everything to that. It's like a little less, it's less directed, or it's not directed, ideally, right? So mindfulness really, it does, like Tanisara was saying, has an intent behind it, right? And it has an intent to really, to understand this life, to gain insight into this life. So there's a willful paying attention. I mean, it is that kind of open, it's not a discursive awareness, it's not an intellectual analysis, but it is very, very close observation, ideally. So we can become very familiar over the course of the day with like, what is our mind state when we wake up? What is, You know, can we be aware of our body as we physically go about our preparations for the morning? When we think about our work, what kind of, you know, mental state arises? Is there aversion arising? You know, we drive on the way to work and there's like run into some traffic. And is there some kind of reaction? We notice that reaction arising within us. And yeah, so, and then like we have Dogen studying the self. So I do think that this is like, this is the active investigation that we do at all other times. And we may do it sometimes, technically sitting on the meditation cushion. You know, sometimes I think it is wonderful to take the opportunity. So let's say you're sitting and you have, you know, some degree of stillness. And then, you know, something is going on in your life. Maybe you're having a relationship issue or something. And you kind of call that to mind. And somehow in that stillness and that openness of meditation, you're able to, you know, bring it into your, you know, binoculars view and just really look at it. Not try to analyze it intellectually, but really look at it. And then sometimes very valuable insights can happen. So sometimes mindfulness, I guess, can even in Zen, can happen on the meditation cushion. I just encourage people to think of that as like, now you're doing something else on the meditation cushion, and that's fine. You're doing something very traditional, doing mindfulness meditation on your meditation cushion, or insight meditation is another way to phrase it. But then hopefully you also make time for shikantaza, which is like, I'm not even trying to figure anything out. I'm not even, you know, good question.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I like both sides, because shikantaza is cool, but it's also cool to like investigate and explore. I just find it interesting. So I guess I'll be doing both.
Yeah. And I mean, we spend the vast majority of our day not in Zazen, right? So really our mindfulness practice in this sense is the rest of the time. Veronica.
This is a great topic, because I found initially, you know, when you start with all the terminology, the difference between mindfulness and meditation seemed confusing, but I think I'm starting to get a little bit, and I've been trying to practice more like how you were saying. I don't remember what examples you gave, but if you're drinking tea, just drink tea. If you're doing Zazen, just sit, like whatever you're doing, do that, right? Rather than, so I've been trying to like drive without putting music on or a podcast. Like when you're driving, I could hear your voice. Like when you're driving, just drive. So I was doing that today in rush hour. It was so busy and it's like big rigs all around. I was like, if you're driving, just drive, just focus on driving. But then I was like thinking about Buddhism and I was lost. And I was like, no, when you're driving, just drive. But it's good practice. And like when I'm making I make pour over coffee, and I'm usually always going around, and I'm like, I try and just stand there. And just when you're making coffee, just make coffee. It's only 5 minutes. So, and I can see that that's different than meditation. It's just all different. They're different, but it's all ties in together, and it's all good practice.
Yeah. You know, this investigative mindfulness. So it's almost like, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, we're using all these words to describe what's a subjective experience that, you know, kind of defies real communication or description sometimes. Because it kind of feels like there's this kind of chill mindfulness. Just that, you know, just doing, just doing whatever it is you're doing. But then, you know, from the Satipatthana Sutta and what he's asking us to do, it's like, it's a little more directive and curious. And I don't know, to me, I almost think of that more as meditation, but a directed investigative meditation, whether we're doing it off the cushion or on, it's, it's strangely close to that kind of just doing what you're doing. It's much closer to that than to our usual intellectual analysis of things. So for instance, like the example I used, if you have, you know, maybe you had a conflict in a relationship recently, and then you know there's something worthwhile to explore there. And you, our ordinary way of doing that is like, well, let's see, you know, I was thinking this and they were thinking this, and you know, I'm right about this or they're right about this, or you know, we think about it, we mull over it, and we try to figure it out. If we are able to do this kind of meditative observation, it feels more like direct observation, even though this thing might be just a little bit in the past. As we draw the memory of that through us, what happens? What arises? Where do we feel it? And what we're looking, observing directly, not analyzing in the abstract, which is where like a real insight can come in. It's like, I think of it as the Buddha was like a scientist, but he studied his own mind. So that's like what we're doing with this mindfulness is, you know, turning toward our own lives, our own minds, our own experience. And if we look closely enough, we will see these deeper truths of life, of that Buddhism is pointing us toward. We will see our fear of death. We will see our grasping. We will see our, you know, trying to, I me and my making. We will see it. Oh, there it is, in a very vivid way. Yeah, Erica.
So, what if we have like an unpleasant experience we have to go through, and it's going to be temporary? Like if, when I go to the dentist, you know, I'm like, I don't really want to be mindful here, you know, like the sound of some drilling, you know, it hurts. Like, I don't want to be mindful. It's not helpful to me. Like in a situation like that, I just concentrate on my breathing, and, you know, I'm thinking about other stuff. So like, am I supposed to be mindful of everything going on in a situation like that?
Well, I mean, again, there's that question of like, what are we going to be mindful of? And I similarly got this idea from Buddhism and from, I don't know, secular mindfulness or whatever, that somehow like ideal mindfulness would be like some kind of hyper aware, I would just be all the sounds and all the smells and all the sights, and I wouldn't miss anything. Like, but that's not really how our mind works, right? Our mind just, you know, sees that and hears that, and if we're paying attention to something, we're not paying attention to the other things. So it's like, to some extent then, right, mindfulness is choosing the right thing to pay attention to. So I guess I could think in that situation, you can notice if I pay attention to the sound of the drill, you know, a lot of aversion arises. If I pay attention to my breathing, I feel more calm. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say write mindfulness in that moment is paying attention to something which brings some more ease. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm sitting in the dentist chair and it's so funny because I'm sure I'm not the only one, but you know, I have ideas about how I should respond to things because I'm a spiritual person. And like the aversion to somebody messing around in my mouth is like, well, it arises anyway. It doesn't matter how spiritual I am. So in some ways then I just kind of observe with mindfulness, like my own nervousness and my own, the fact that like my hands keep going like this, you know, and okay, let's relax. Lots of things to pay attention to there. Brian. You're still muted.
Yeah, I gotta keep pushing buttons. Okay. I compartmentalize. That's me. Zazen is Zazen. That's all there is. It's just sit, not meditate, just sit, breathe, try to keep an open mind, see if something comes in, observe it, label it, say bye-bye. It's like, a train station. Wave at the train, go through. To me, that is how I do my Zazen. Meditation, to me, is not Zazen for me. It's different. It's meditation, and I have different categories even of that. There's the meditation of guided meditations I like to listen to. Certain gurus, certain teachers are doing something, I'm listening to them, and it's like absorbing and going through like that. Or I pick like a koan or something, and then I just gurgitate it. Just sit there and go through it and through it. And then I've got about four or five different buckets how I put them into. And that's the meditation part, separate from the Zazen. Mm-hmm. And then in between the two, when you're not in Zazen, you're not really meditating, that's where the mindfulness comes into me. It's when I'm, like you said, off the cushion. At that point, it's how can I follow the Eightfold Path and that on a day-to-day basis, or when I'm doing something, being mindful, paying attention to what I'm doing when I'm doing it. But that is not really meditation. It's just a way of being aware and accepting what's going on, good and bad. It's a separate style. And because I just keep going from that, like I'll use mindfulness, to me is more related to metta. And that basically, you know, it's being mindful of everything around you and being, you know, giving goodwill to other people. It's not analyzing, but if I want to analyze, I go back to meditation. It's like, so I have these like game plans for each thing. And it's like a switch, you know, like when you're driving, yes, I'll try to be mindful not to yell at the guy beside me and not cut him off and, you know, other things, and try to be natural. But to me, the Zazen is completely different. I maybe they all eventually melt together, but for me, they're still compartmentalized.
And I think you're describing it the way that I think of Zen as presenting it. How we tend to use it. But I think it's useful to know that the original teachings, and then in Theravada Buddhism, the word mindfulness is pointing toward a particular faculty of mind, which is to remember, and return. So we're doing that when we're doing what we call mindfulness, right? Returning to, you know, what it is we're doing to our direct experience. But then when we are meditating, if we're choosing something to contemplate, then mindfulness is remembering to return to that remembering, or to, you know, keeping that subject, that topic in our frame of reference. So, you know, that's kind of a, that's legitimate. So like, I guess we're using a little bit of mindfulness in the course of our meditation. And for that matter, you know, when we're sitting shikantaza, we're using mindfulness to remember to sit shikantaza, right? When our mind goes off like this and we say, ah, yes, sit. That is that faculty of mindfulness. Right. Well, dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahaprajnam Paramita. Good night. Thank you for being here. Or good morning.
Don't you all have that?